This week, despite solid economic numbers, most markets took a much-needed rest. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you on the September 7th show. We have another two big guest interviews. Season 13, episode 660 begins with a series of setbacks for commodities and precious metals markets in recent weeks. When will the tide turn for the gold bulls? This week's guests think the timing may be irrelevant, that every investor should procure gold insurance. These are discounted prices, and once the economic fallout hits hard, including this potential trade war, we're all going to need a little gold and silver. Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, economist from Boston University, says gold and silver investors will eventually be victorious. Over $200 trillion in U.S. debt and obligations, plus the trade war, virtually guarantees it, noting that he thinks the U.S. government is completely bankrupt. He's got the numbers to back it up. Then the listener Q&A segment includes three new callers with questions on various topics, including the Kinesis Project. And Bill Murphy from Gotta returns with his thoughts on the markets, noting the silver to gold ratio is now way up in the 85 range, making it one of the most irresistible values in monetary and financial history. The more traditional ratio is 10 or even 15 to 1. So 85 to 1, just on that ratio alone, if we return to the norm, could mean fireworks in the coming years for silver investors. We also discuss the 1,000,000% inflation in Venezuela, and now their neighbor has ratcheted up rates to 60% as their government tries to battle a currency crisis as well. The Argentine peso plus the now defunct Venezuelan bolivar might be the harbingers of trouble ahead for the greenback. And remember, we'd like for you to sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter to help us keep the lights on here at the show. We have at least five solid stock candidates, which usually includes a gold stock or two, plus all the crypto insights. If you haven't yet signed up, still offering a few giveaways, plus a free Bitcoin wallet. And the Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. We'd like for you to call in with your questions and comments, 641-715-3900. And you'll need the mailbox number. It's just six digits, 514049. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Ominous clouds persisted over the precious metals sector this week. Still, gold held support at almost exactly $1,200 amid the potential of global inflation following the trade war. At Friday's closing bell, gold was off just $6.30 for the week, finishing at $1,200. Silver shed 37 cents at $1,407, while the XAU precious metals dropped 3.21, 5%, closing at $63. Black gold gave back $2, 3%, finishing at $67.75. The Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, fell $1.16, 12%, finishing at $8.34. Well, the top story impacting precious metals this week, U.S. job growth accelerated in August, with wages posting the best annual increase in 9 years, despite the trade war. The U.S. Labor Department registered 201,000 new jobs in August, holding the unemployment rate at an 18-year low of around 3.9%. The better-than-expected figure included an annual rate of pay increase of around 3%, up about 0.2%. That was the best showing in about a decade. The strong jobs report was viewed as supportive of expected rate hikes from the Fed at the next policy FOMC meeting slated for this month, September 26. Currently 99.8% probability of a rate hike this month, and then at the December meeting, we would jump up from 2.25% to 2.5%, about a 77% probability showing up in the Fed funds futures contracts at the St. Louis Fed's website. Turning to domestic economic news, officials in Washington are calling for an additional $267 billion in tariffs against China, that on the heels of the proposed $200 billion on Chinese products. Of course, this surprised investors, as the new $267 billion in taxes could be announced at any moment, according to sources. 25% tariffs on $200 billion is roughly 40% of China's exports, and that's scheduled to go in effect imminently. Valley. So far, officials in China have responded using game theory, but at a lower tariff tax pace. According to one media source, the U.S. could decide to implement tariffs all at once, but it might come after the midterm elections. Bottom line on precious metals. The U.S. dollar pulled back did little to encourage precious metals bulls. Virtually every market decline that I can find, even the short-term and 30-year bond market, treasuries, pulled back sharply. The only ray of light I can see on the horizon at this point is the holiday buying season that is just around the corner for gold and silver. Turning to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies returned over the New York Stock Exchange this week as the U.S. equities market pulled back over continued trade war concerns with China. The Dow was off fractionally about 48 points, ending at 25,916. The S&P 500 was off 30 at 2872, while the NASDAQ gave back 207 points, 2.55%, bringing it under that 8,000 level, closing at 7902. The top story moving the markets, investors are monitoring talks between U.S., Canada, and Mexico amid efforts to revamp the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. For the most part, progress seems to be solid. However, the trade war with the world's second largest economic superpower continues to plague the sector, which helped send high-flying technology sector off 3% for the week. Major decliners included Microsoft was off about 4%, while Facebook tumbled about 7%. Positive stocks in the news included Alibaba Group. BABA is the ticker. Shares climbed about 1.6% on news of a stock buyback program. Michael's company was up 4% after it also announced a stock buyback program of about $500 million. But it was Tesla that maybe caught investors' attention. It was off 6.3% as CEO Elon Musk was filmed smoking a cannabis spliff. The electric car maker's chief accountant resigned, which did concern investors a bit. And of course, as I mentioned, Elon Musk did imbibe in cannabis during the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. Meanwhile, shares of Roku, one of our favorites here for years, added 2.6%. The media streaming company ended close to a record high of around $66 on Friday. However, we continue to promote Amazon's Fire Stick. It's a superior product at a much better value, and there's very little to argue with the consensus that it will replace Roku if they don't revamp their product. U.S. shares, bottom line. The USA Today 7 indicator greed to fear index pendulum fell back into neutral category. This is viewed as something of a plus, as we're mostly near record high in the markets. Assuming that the trade war dissipates after this small sell-off, I would expect to see higher highs in the weeks and months ahead on U.S. shares. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Pleasure to welcome back Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University, economics professor.
Nice to be back with you.
You had an interesting article from Forbes, A Total Trade War. People are either terribly concerned or just completely dismissing the threat of our top trading partners getting fed up with the U.S. Can you tell us more?
Well, yeah, they are getting fed up and they're slapping tariffs on us. This is not a joke. You know, these tariffs are being applied as we speak, and more appear to be coming. Trump has threatened $200 billion in tariffs on Chinese products, and ultimately perhaps putting on tariffs on every single Chinese product, and they'll, of course, do the same with us. But since we're a number of products, their tariffs, in order to retaliate, are going to be focused on things like soybean at a much higher rate. So it could put the soybean industry if not out of operation, certainly out of profitability for quite a while. And they can switch suppliers, and we never see a soybean recovery. So the idea that this guy can go into a shop and start swinging a wrecking ball and think everything is going to be fine, it just shows the inanity of this. They're not going to put up with it. So trying to negotiate a separate deal with with Mexico and leaving out Canada. Well, Canada's not going to be not accepting that. So we could have a breakdown of trade with Canada. It's not clear whether Mexico will ultimately, it's not clear how much of what was decided with Mexico was actually just a show or was substantive. But the whole thinking process that you're here, the whole thought process that we need to have balanced trade. We have a country that's hooked on consumption. We're kind of consumption junkies. And the reason that we're running a trade deficit is because we're consuming so much that we're saving so little. We have so little income left over to save. Therefore, we can and cannot invest because we don't have any wherewithal to invest at a reasonable rate. And other countries see investment opportunities in the U.S. and they come and invest and they bring their capital goods over, and that shows up as a trade deficit. So the reason that we're running a trade deficit has nothing to do with unfair trade practices. It has everything to do with 3% national saving rate, which used to be 15% in 1950. And any decent economist who has studied international trade will tell you that. I'm not even an expert in international, I don't specialize in international trade, but economics 101, it's crazy. Started a trade war with complete crazy notions about trade. You know, there are some legitimate concerns about intellectual property interacting with China and with their requirements that they have over 51% ownership of foreign companies that invest in China. Well, you respond to that specifically, not via a huge war. You know, if you have say, okay, look, if you want to play that way, we'll play the same way with you. Namely, your companies, when they invest here, have to hand over all their intellectual property, and we have to have 51% ownership. You just pass the law, treat them symmetrically, and they'll back off. It doesn't. But now he's made this a mano-a-mano, who's got the bigger cojones here. President Xi in China is running a country with 1.2 or so people, and they're all nationalistic, and they've been pumped up to be nationalistic, and he cannot back down publicly. Canadian Prime Minister is not going to publicly back down, and this is all becoming a very big public trying to say publicly, I'm going to intimidate these people.
Obviously, we've had some inconsistencies and some imbalances within our global trade and with our top trading partners for decades.
And even today, we have very high tariffs on things that we're protecting with other countries. So it's not like our tariffs on average have been a lot lower than those of our competitors. It's not the case at all. So there are grievances on both sides. That wasn't a crisis before he got into office. It doesn't need to be a crisis now.
Kind of veering us back here, though, to the economic picture, you point out in some of your recent literature, we're seeing trade agreements around the world, especially between, you know, the BRICS nations, in particular China, Russia, Asia, and then again with the Middle East, which has kind of been left out of a lot of these discussions. I'd like your thoughts on the significance of that and how it might strategically hurt the United States economically.
Yeah, we've engaged in a trade war with the European Union and China. Canada and Mexico, collectively, their economies are about 2.5 times.
Look at Europe. I mean, they're upset with us over our 25% tariff on their autos, right?
Yeah, I don't know if that's been actually implemented yet or that's just a threat. There's certainly been steel taxes, tariffs. But even the European Union by itself has a bigger economy than ours, probably by 10-15%. The idea that the U.S. can call the shots on its own, they are going to go around us. And we will be left in the dust. Our country is on a long-term path to become economically insignificant. We need to understand, as part of this entire conversation, the U.S. right now has 17% of world GDP. After World War II, we were probably around 40-50% of world GDP. Now we're 17%. By the end of the century, given the demographic projections of the U.N., we're going to have another two Chinas in the world in terms of population, and if we get catch-up productivity growth in the areas where this demographic increase is happening, is projected to happen, the U.S. will have at the end of the century in 2100 just 5% of world GDP. It will be to the world's economy what Germany is to the world's economy today, which is a bit player, not a country that can call the shots. We won't have the
economic strength to police the world, to wage wars with no end and no clear path to an end or victory, not even a definition of what victory is. Endless numbers of years in Afghanistan, we're going on to 18 years, entire kind of stance of the U.S., and it's not just the current president administration, the Democrats also, entire set of politicians have this mindset that America is going to maintain its hegemonic position through time. It's not in the economic cards. It's not in the demographic cards. It's not in the productivity growth rate cards. We can't even get, man, you know, in the last year and a half, we're saying that this economy is better than it's ever been. It's not better than it's ever been. There's been zero wage growth in the last 12 months, zero real wage growth. Just look at the BLS numbers. The 6 months before that, we had about 0.5% real wage growth. So over 18 months, this we've had on an annual basis, less than 0.5% of, basically about 0.25% less, 1/3% in real wage growth. And that's not economic progress. That's stagnation. That's what you see other countries growing in real terms. Ours is sitting still. The fact that everybody's employed but making no money is not a great achievement.
And, you know, we are seeing the implications of, or fallout, you might say, of some of these policies. For instance, with Canada, our neighbor to the north, we're seeing an increase in at least 10% in lumber used in new home construction, which is hitting new home sales, increasing the typical home, according to a recent report.
That could precipitate another crash, economic crash, like we saw in 2008. People are leveraged again, and it doesn't take much to panic the economy. Right now, everybody's on a, basically, we've got a bull run, everybody's upbeat. He's produced an environment for economic collapse. I view the collapse we saw in 2008 as indicative of what we in economics call multiple equilibria, where people collectively panic, they collectively fire. They fire because they think other people are firing, and then you go from great times to terrible times from 1 minute to the next, and that's really what we saw in 2008. 10 years today, if you go back to September 15th when Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, the firing started happening within a few weeks, and it reached 700,000 unemployed in December.
This idea you brought up of multiple equilibria, if you will, I mean, we can see these issues precipitate into a confluence of negative events that hit at the same time, and that can lead to like an avalanche of difficulties, as we saw in the Great Recession, they call it, 2008-2009. What do you say to folks who maybe are pointing to the revision in NAFTA? Can you find any positives there for the U.S.?
I'm sure there's some good things, but I mean, let's take, for example, the requirement that the Mexicans pay their workers $16 an hour, their auto workers. Now they're being paid $3 an hour. This is really the basic dilemma here for the U.S. workers, which is we don't have a very well-educated workforce or well-trained. We don't have the kind of apprenticeship programs they have in Germany and Switzerland. So our kids are coming into the workforce with very bad, very poor education, elementary school and high school, generally not great apprenticeship programs. They're not hooked in with companies who have been guiding them, and they're not as productive as they need to be. And then they've got competition from countries all around the world, not just in Mexico, where people, there's so many workers who are well-trained and very disciplined are willing to work at dramatically lower wages. And that's why almost everything you buy these days that's been, you know, actually made by a person is being brought in from China or some other emerging country. So if we put on, if we require the Mexicans to pay their workers $16 an hour, we'll destroy the auto industry in Mexico and it'll just move to a different country. So it's not like we're going to get a real wage increase for the Mexicans. It's what we're going to do is get a real wage reduction for the Americans, because every worker in the U.S. who is trying to buy a car is going to face a higher price of cars. If we extended that rule that any auto part, any car has to be delivered here based on labor that's paid, let's say $3,000 an hour, why not take it to the extreme? Then the only cars that will be made here will be made by GM and Ford and Chrysler, and they'll be priced at a much higher level price, and the American workers' paycheck will buy less. So we're not talking about a real wage hike for the Mexicans. We're talking about a real wage cut for the Americans. That's what his policy and trade is producing, which is real economic decline in the U.S. It's one thing if we had some special leverage, you know, some way in which we could manipulate trade tariffs to get much higher prices in the world market for our goods that we're making. That's not the strategy here, and that's not the preconditions.
We're not going to give any specific investment advice today, but you have pointed out your grave concerns with regard to U.S. Treasuries. You see this and view this as one of the more risky assets, which so many advisors would say that should be a core component. Maybe 50%, you know, as a person approaches retirement, for every 10 years, you want to increase your bond exposure another 10%. That's the typical rule of thumb, primarily due to that $200 trillion in U.S. debt you see in liabilities.
Yeah, the U.S. Government is entirely bankrupt. Almost all our liabilities, 90%, are off the books. So we're not facing $20 trillion in official debt, we're facing $200 trillion in official and unofficial debt. An example of an unofficial debt is $34 trillion in unfunded liabilities to pay for Social Security benefits. That number is hidden away in the trustees' report of the Social Security Administration. So we've got these massive off-the-book liabilities, Medicare, Medicaid, defense spending into the future. The country's broke. So when a country's broke, they typically tend to print money. That can lead to inflation. We're already seeing inflation picking up, long-term rates going up a bit. So the big concern with the fiscal side is that long-term rates will go up and that long-term treasuries will sink in value. If we have a recession, there will probably be a flight to safety, and treasuries will do better on that score, especially short-term treasuries. So I would say the real danger is with long-term U.S. treasuries, and short-term treasuries might be relatively safe. It might even be a decent hedge against what could be a major recession if we get, you know, people get sufficiently pessimistic collectively. If there's a triggering event here, for example, we slap $200 billion tariffs on $200 billion worth of U.S. Chinese products, and the Chinese do that the next day to us, that could be the kind of triggering event that could flip our equilibrium to one of recession, not expansion. In terms of investments, yeah, I think the stock market is quite risky, even independent of Trump and the trade war that's emerging. The fact is that price-earning ratios are extremely high, and I don't think this is a good time to be in the stock market. I think looking at bonds of countries that are well run, like Canadian bonds, and countries, you know, Canada is a country that has an undervalued exchange rate, it seems, that might be a play that might be worth considering. I'm just very nervous about the market, that people are underestimating the damage that a trade war can produce. And we're heading into a trade war. You know, we've already started the trade war with Bob Woodward. Just wrote an entire 465 or so page book describing in minute detail, and he's running our world economy, our world economic policy. So one should be adopting the title of Woodward's book, which is Fear. One should be taking on fear, and when you're fearful about when you realize that there's more uncertainty about the economy, and the world economy, and the U.S. economy, and there's got to be more uncertainty today than there was 3 years ago, what you do, according to economics, is you cut back on your exposure to risky assets. So you time the market not to try and get a higher return, but you time it to lower your risk. And that's what economics predicts. So the mantra that we've heard in the last 50 or so years by economists and Wall Street, that you don't try and time the market, nobody can beat the market, that's true. But there's another lesson from economic theory that has not been expressed, which is when things get risky, you get out. And things are more risky. So everybody should be moving out, I think, given the extra risk. And that's not I'm sure the market's going to crash tomorrow. What I am sure is that we've got more risk today than we had yesterday, yesterday being a couple of years ago. People should, according to economic theory, finance theory, play it safer. Entirely eliminate your stock holdings, but it means you cut them back.
Can you envision a scenario where our key trading partner, China, with trillions of dollars in U.S. treasuries, presses the nuclear option, divests large sums, maybe gives up on our trade due to this trade war, thereby just crushing the greenback and causing Argentine or even Venezuelan-style currency issues, maybe even inflation? And in such a scenario, would a strong hedge like precious metals protect investors somewhat from the fallout?
Yeah, absolutely. We should be diversified. If you're asking about gold and other metals, for sure that should be part of a balanced portfolio. Help avoid to diversify against the risk. And yeah, there's all kinds of things that could happen if things get sufficiently out of hand. China's sitting on lots of U.S. bonds. They could dump them on the market, probably gradually, so they don't suffer a loss themselves. But if word of that gets out, it will lead interest rates to go sky high, and then you have a lot of people, and then they'll go even higher because people realize that the U.S. government has to pay interest on, at a much higher rate, on its large official debt. All these things interact can lead to the kinds of things we saw in 2008, which is serial financial collapse and economic collapse. One thing leading to the next, the domino is falling. Goes down, AIG goes down the next week. Citigroup has to be, Merrill Lynch goes the same weekend as Lehman Brothers. Citigroup has to be bailed out, and the stock market falls 60%. Yes, it fell 60%, I think, between 2008, September 15th, 2008, the middle of 2009. I believe it dropped about 60%, the S&P.
Exactly, and without all the helicopter drops and the rest of the bailouts, can you imagine what would have really happened? I mean, it could have been a 1929 to 1932, like 89-90% drop.
Yeah, 86% between 1929 and the bottom, the trough in 33, I believe, it was an 86% drop in the stock market. And yeah, we've got Dodd-Frank and the Republican Congress right now. It could still be a Republican Congress. And Dodd-Frank is very clear that the government cannot bail out companies like they could prior to the passage of Dodd-Frank. The whole impetus of Dodd-Frank was that Wall Street should not be bailed out. What they didn't do was fundamentally fix the banking system so that we wouldn't have leveraged financial intermediaries, middlemen, who could bring down the financial exchange and could in effect blackmail us to bail them out. They never fixed anything fundamental. They just rebuilt the thing in straw, and we could have another hurricane. So, and be in worse position to deal with it because the Dodd-Frank has put on certain more restrictions on what the Fed and the Treasury can do.
You know, clearly the previous act that separate the banking powers from the investment banking side and our key money lenders, when that came to pass, it allowed for what we saw build up to 2008-2009. And it's never really been addressed by legislators. So you could argue we're just setting up for another 1929-style collapse, which could maybe even be worse this time because we don't have the economic base, you might agree, the manufacturing base to pull us back up. As we close, any parting thoughts for listeners?
These are very dangerous times for us personally, economically, and for our nation's political cohesion, for its democracy. Thinking seriously about such a danger to ourselves and to our children and to the world, and I'm not saying whether I like them or not, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. You have to be thinking about the country, so I would appeal to people to think about how they're going to vote in November. Just read Woodward's book about described it as an implicit coup d'etat. So anyway, that's my parting thought. I appreciate being on the show. My website is kotlikoff.net.
We'll make sure we have that link up, kotlikoff.net. And, of course, Amazon.com has some of his latest books there as well. Professor Kotlikoff, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
opening up the phone lines for listeners Q&A.
Hey, Chris, Marcus here. I really enjoyed your conversation with Bob Boy on this week's show. Couldn't help but wondering when you and he were discussing Bitcoin cryptocurrencies and looking for a digital currency moving forward that politicians and bankers can't mess up. I couldn't help but thinking about the Kinesis project that Andrew McGuire and Tom Coughlin are working on. Just curious to get your thoughts on whether or not you think that that concept that they are moving forward with using a bullion backing to their token, if that could potentially fit that niche that we're all looking for. So thank you very much. I really enjoy all your hard work and the great shows. Thanks.
First up, longtime listener and friend of the show, Marcus, starts off today's discussion with comments on Andrew McGuire and CEO Coughlin Kinesis project. That's a gold-backed cryptocurrency, a project down under that's caught the attention of many bigwigs in the precious metals and financial community. You know, Marcus, I appreciate the kind words and the question. According to GoldSeek's top brass, Peter Spina and his folks, Kinesis is above board. We're supporting and continue to expect big things from the Kinesis team. I'm posting their latest project paper in PDF format, which I highly recommend people thoroughly study. So you can find that either on the main GoldSeek Radio page or our Nuggets page. One key caveat, and we have to include this whenever we're talking about really anything. So this is nothing directed specifically at Kinesis. It's just a, many of my longtime listeners know we cannot be too careful. You know, initial public offerings and ICOs involve extremely high risks. As again, we learned last year. Here's an example. I started off a few years ago with the Komodo ICO. It was a stealth currency, had an excellent underwriter at Smith and Crown, which I highly recommend bookmarking that website. It turned out to be one of the best performers in ICO history from its 50-fold opening price, first day price, to about the same as you would have paid pre-token, you know, pre-ICO for the, so you could say that since the tokens were locked up and could not be sold off, it was a wash. Later, the tokens did skyrocket back up even higher, but for most of the people involved, it was too late. Here's the key takeaway point. In most cases, it's safest to wait until an ICO goes public and let that organic price discovery, the market forces, the invisible hand, let that reveal the true value. Here's another case in point. Like many of my colleagues, I was extremely interested in the SALT, S-A-L-T lending platform, ICO. Allows everyday folks to just take their currency, their Bitcoin, Ethereum, whatnot, convert it into Bitcoin, and then borrow against it with a unique, highly dynamic margin slicer, I call it. Which instead of getting a margin call some morning, it'll just slice off a little bit of the Bitcoin you've deposited if the price were to drop below the margin amount. They were very legit, vetted every single American user, spent thousands of hours making sure everything was above board and legally compliant. Nevertheless, the price mostly fell. After the ICO, it did bounce back, I think, to the opening price, and to this point, it's still in recovery. Would love to see it bottom out if it hasn't already. Haven't looked at it in a while. Unless you can get in at pre-ICO offering price, I think they usually refer to this as the beta level. I've got to be a proponent of waiting until after the ICO, watching the weekly chart bottom out. Now, there is another option I have for a lot of my listeners here. If you have extra time and you'd like some free ICOs, I have a list found that you might not be able to find yourself. Now, it might take 20 to 30 minutes or even more to get those free ICOs, but once you get accustomed to using some of the phone apps, some of the phone messaging apps, I think you'll be ready to go. So just send me a message at gsr@hughes.net. GSR@Hughes.net. I'll fire that over to you, and I'll try to remember to post the link here. But I really prefer to stay in touch with my folks. So if you really want the link, I have it bookmarked. Just send over a request. Thanks again, Marcus. Next up, John, now in sunny San Diego.
Chris, listen to the latest installment of GoldSeek Radio, and you seem rather skeptical of a deflationary crash. Personally, I think there's probably going to be a mixture of two, deflation followed by hyperinflation. But I just heard an interview with Charles Nenner on USA Watchdog, and he is committed to the deflationary scenario and he says that the stock market will not crash until 2020. Whether Nenner is right on this one or not is, of course, speculation. Maybe you want to have Nenner on to hash this out with you, because you seem very skeptical of the deflationary scenario. Personally, I don't think it matters all that much. Deflation, hyperinflation, whatever. Gold is going to go up once the you-know-what hits the fan, and they lose control. The physical market will break the back of the paper market and discredit New York and London, and all the gold seekers will move over to Shanghai or Hong Kong or somewhere else in Asia. Wherever the gold is flowing, that is where the buyers will go. They can't get their gold in New York right now. Anybody that wants the gold, as you probably know, they're being directed to London to get their gold. Either New York doesn't have any gold or they're sitting at it and they don't want to surrender any. So I don't know what's going on at the COMEX, but this exchange for physical gambit, certainly suspicious. I think you would agree. Anybody would agree. Why would the COMEX direct futures buyers who stand for delivery, why would they direct them to London? Why? There aren't very many answers to that. They're either they don't have the gold or they don't want to part with it. Those are the only two answers. Let's see what he has to say about all this.
As you probably know, the yield curve is as flat as a pancake presently, and some pundits say it's going to invert, and that portends big changes in the financial sector in the coming months or weeks. So, as you know, the bond market is the key to everything. The price of money is always the key. So, because things are starting to look very dicey in the bond market. All right, thanks. Great show. Keep up the good work.
Hi, John. You know, Charles Nenner, solid friend of the show. In fact, he's scheduled to be back on the show, but he was in Israel at the time, and it was a little too costly at that time. We hope to have him back on soon, along with David Gurwitz, our favorite rabbi. As for the COMEX situation, you know, we've heard for years now from the Ghana folks that there's simply too little gold to cover the contract, something like maybe 1 ounce for every 100 contracts, and I've seen worse, 150 contracts. James Turk regularly warned our listeners for over a decade that a potential force majeure could unfold at any point that could maybe even send sort of a domino-like effect rippling through the gold exchanges around the world from London to Frankfurt, New York, you name it, Beijing, Shanghai. You know, I probably need to bring this up to Bix Weir next time he's on the show. He's done considerable due diligence, if I remember correctly, in this area. You know, I've been talking about the flattening of the yield curve for several months now. I've regularly outlined my expectations for the short end to eclipse the longer end by summer of next year. And that, of course, as the Fed wraps up its rate hike cycle, which we currently expect looking at the St. Louis Fed's Fed Funds futures. We're also seeing the EU, China, and Japan turn a little more hawkish, raise their rates, and follow in the Fed's footsteps. I believe that's going to put the greenback eventually under some pressure. As money flows, global, big global money flows in the Forex towards the yen, yuan, and euro instead of the dollar in anticipation of higher yields. It could also put some pressure on U.S. stock market. I think as soon as January, February of next year, we might just see some pressure come in, obviously after the January effect and tax-related selling. Maybe it'll wait as long as sell in May and walk away, which is the more traditional time to see weakness in U.S. equities. However, markets like the Nikkei, the DAX, and the Shanghai, I think, could benefit. So that's something to keep in mind because there are ETFs. Higher rates are the death knell for the longer end. So I agree with Boston University professor Lawrence Kotlikoff that you're going to see much safer, maybe even returns on the short end of the bond market in your T-bills and T-notes as opposed to your longer 10 and 30-year bonds. Great questions, John. Next, it's Trent.
Hello, Chris. Hi, this is Trent, and I'm an ambassador from the SoundDeck.io blockchain. SoundDeck allows for artists to create royalty-payment smart contracts on the blockchain. Any person who creates audio content can earn crypto tokens based off how many users stream their content on a daily basis. The blockchain takes care of storing all the streaming statistics and calculating the rewards. The reason why I'm calling you is because it would be a good recommendation, and basically you could earn some crypto from that. And then other users that have maybe they're musicians and they have some recordings, they can actually post their audio content and not have to even go through a record company to actually earn some royalties. For more information, you can visit SoundDeck.io. That's S O-U-N-D-A-C smartcasier.io. If you go there, there's instructions on how you can upload your content and create your smart contracts for royalties. If you have any questions, you can contact me at 704-865-0234. And at 704-865-0234. Thank you.
Hi, Trent. It sounds interesting, and potentially it could, I think, you know, ignite a creativity revolution as artists have greater incentives to, you know, share their best work. And I'd suggest that though people do their due diligence here, as always, I don't know if this has gone ICO. I'm not following it. All the earlier provisos and caveats on ICOs apply. Hat tip for bringing this up to us. Certainly sounds like something worth investigating. I'd point out to everyone that we are in a bear market in the crypto space. And until that changes, which we've seen some signs of life come back into Bitcoin over 7,200, 7,300, but I want to see Ethereum come back to life too. If we can see that, then typically, and we get over that 10 to 12,000 point on Bitcoin and march back to the former December 2017 highs, then it might be time to start looking at some of the other tokens and coins out there. But again, Trent, thanks for bringing it up. Keep listening. And we'd like for all of you to share enthusiasm for GoldSeek, SilverSeek, and GoldSeek.com radio. It's really word of mouth that helps us so much. And by doing so and signing up for my newsletter, the Alpha Stocks newsletter, where I give you my regular favorite gold stocks, silver stocks, as well as a portfolio of extremely scientifically balanced portfolio each week with solid betas. But more importantly, it's that alpha that gives you the boost above the typical portfolio that you try to put together. I started in 98. It's almost 2019. Honed this scientific process using proprietary algorithms as well as some proprietary software. So if you want to know what the computer thinks and what the computer is investing in, be sure and sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. Also, that's where I put all of my latest crypto insights, favorite ICOs, topicality. So you don't want to miss out on it. And plus, we're giving away a free crypto wallet when you sign up for an annual subscription. You don't have to subscribe if you don't. You can just buy a 1 year. If you want to, or do it monthly, or whatever you like. Sign up, you go 5 years to 10 years, I give you about $100,000 in the testnet Ethereum, which is already worth, believe it or not, worth some real Bitcoin. And one day we think it could be as valuable as Ethereum is right now on the testnet. It wouldn't hurt to have 100 Ethereum I'm giving away with every 5 year, 3 year, and 10 year new subscription on the testnet, plus some other neat crypto assets, which I think is going to be a $10 to $100 billion market just in of itself. Just think CryptoKitties and crypto pets. We're giving away crypto pets to our 5 and 10 year and annual subscribers. So if you've been on the sidelines, if you've been on the fence, why not sign up? Thanks, folks, for calling in. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek Radio.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, it's just great to have Bill Murphy back with us from the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, God of Chris Powell, giving us hope that things are going to turn around. You had some interesting thoughts on what might be unfolding here.
Well, Chris, thanks for having me back. But yeah, I've been writing for months in my commentary. My opinion, it's just a hunch, but I've been consistent with it for months, that since this raid of June 15th, which was so obvious and blatant, that the gold cartel has gone in action to enact an endgame in the sense of they've made it, they'd get out of their short positions as much as possible. And they made it so easy to trade from the short side with only one little rally in gold that the specs have made a lot of money on the short side. They're getting shorter and shorter. None of the normal things have worked that other people have talked about, the commitment of traders report in the commercials and all this stuff, and the commercials being long silver for the first time in maybe, I don't know, 17, 18 years. Nothing's meant anything. It's just been straight down, especially silver, in which the gold-silver ratio has gone, 84.5. It went right to 84.5. My thinking, Chris, is and they're doing this to get out of their short positions, and it's going to lead to some spectacular moves on the upside this fall. And if that is correct, and it may not be, the moves have to be dramatic because they can't go back and start selling to do at least a lot of selling like they always do when the specs cover. You've got to get some violent moves for this to play out. But this has been in my talking point for months now, and it's playing out that way.
anywhere near 80 to 85 on the gold to silver ratio. If I had any extra dineros left in my piggy bank and I couldn't afford the metal, I would look at LEAPS, you know, those long-term equity 2-year out LEAPS. You could get just slightly out of the money calls on silver, the ETF SLV.
You're right. The risk reward in silver is the best of probably all time, even at the very bottom, because I think this price, when this end game is done, if I'm correct, silver's on its way to 100 and is going to get there faster than anybody can think.
You know, there's a disconnect, obviously, between our favorites, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, and the traditional commodities sector. Is this just the doldrums, Bill Murphy, ahead of the holiday festivities where they tend to accumulate the metal?
You know, my subject, but I'm going back to the gold cartel again. On the move down since the middle of June, it was a total disconnect also with the dollar. At one point just last week, the dollar hadn't changed at all, and gold was, you know, $100, nearly $100, you know, off its high when it broke down. It wasn't as high, but when it broke down at 1304. So there's disconnects all over the place, and that goes back to my end game analysis of what's going on. So, and then, of course, with other assets doing so well and gold and silver doing so poorly, it's just natural for people just to, you know, give up the ghost. But I don't think they should, but it's understandable.
Because of the short-term trading mentality that seems to be so prevalent today. But I think longer-term, if we look at this tariff situation, I mean, obviously that's inflationary, but these are serious taxes. You know, we have the Fed probably wrapping up its rate hiking schedule as soon as early summer of next year. That'll be the end. Maybe two more rate hikes next year. That's roughly 6 months from December. The markets, I think, are going to start discounting the rate hiking cycle, which should just light a fire under the precious metals. So add the holiday season buying, January effect, Fed wrapping up probably mid-2019 at the latest. You know, we've got the flattening of the yield curve, all of which bodes well, I think, for gold and especially silver. So one interesting bit of topicality here. Argentina now, the latest to show some signs of runaway inflation. We've all heard of Venezuela's 1,000,000% on the bolivar. Well, the peso, the Argentine peso, interest rates to 60% today as its peso plunges just like the bolivar was doing over the past few years. Is this systemic? I mean, is this just, once they open Pandora's box, it just spreads from country to country?
Well, it's hard to say. I remember Zimbabwe. You remember way back when that didn't mean anything except for Zimbabwe. But certainly the emerging countries have some issues, and it's starting to feed on itself a little bit, like you mentioned. And it would take a while, I think, to have any effect here, but all of a sudden it could affect financial markets and create some serious crises. I mean, they're already serious if you live in some of these countries. Eventually, it's going to bring the investing world back to gold and silver. So it can only be a big asset for the precious metals down the road.
We just read today from GATA.org that President Nicolas Maduro and First Lady Cilia Flores are talking about a gold-backed certificate to crush the current hyperinflation. You couldn't ask for anything more appropriate, and they want personal savings to be, you know, returned and see their economy turn around. And to do that, you can't have prices changing 5 times a day. People don't know what's going on. They're afraid to save because, you know, what do you save in?
Well, you're absolutely right. It can only be a big positive. And again, it's going back to what's lasted throughout time and in a sense of security and where to feel safe with your funds. And right now in the United States, you know, we've gone a long period of time here with the stock market going up and up and up. As I mentioned earlier, other assets, fear has really evaporated. All of a sudden, that fear comes back and things can change dramatically and quickly. And again, going back to the end game scenario, I think that the bad guys, the gold cartel, know what is coming, and they're taking measures, took it this summer, to get out of a lot of their positions, and they're still doing it.
But ultimately, it still sounds a little bit more like a paper money scheme, because where is the gold held?
I just feel very comfortable that we're getting set up for something dramatic in gold and silver, and this has been a real struggle and really tedious to deal with all summer long, but again, I'll finish up with what I mentioned throughout this commentary, that I believe this is an end game in process. When they're finished, look out to what's coming for gold and silver on the upside this fall.
And maybe we should qualify where those funds are going to flow from. Last week, we had a longtime friend of the show, Nick Barashev, on. He's from BMG Bullion Management Group. Of course, they store with Brinks a huge amount of yellow metal for investors. And, of course, the author of $10,000 Gold, he raises some points, noting there's such a tiny sliver, not even fraction, of the world's wealth, $300 trillion in global bonds and stocks, for instance, less than $1.8 trillion in gold. Just the slightest change in mentality, in our thinking process, in groupthink, away from the risk-on trade, if you will, to the more conservative, safe haven-like assets, could ignite gold and silver similar to Bitcoin in 2018, which was a 20x in 12 months.
Well, I've mentioned it before, Chris. That's what I think is coming for silver. It's going to, once it gets above 21, it's going to trade in very volatile fashion on the upside and get to 100 much faster than people can think. So there'll be a lot of excitement and fun coming back into our sector and a lot of money to be made.
You can really, I think, look all over the globe and start to see that even in the periphery, things are starting to unwind. And at some point, maybe just a touch of insurance might not be such a bad idea.
Today is the seventh year anniversary of the gold making its top in September of 2011, the day after Labor Day. So it'd be an appropriate time.
Contact information, please, from Gatta and La Metropole.
www.gatta.org does a great job. And I've been doing La Metropole Cafe now for exactly 20 years. People can sign up for a two-week free trial to see if it is of interest.
All right, Bill Murphy, let's look forward to better times in 2019.
Chris, thank you.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Against the backdrop of ever-increasing fake news propaganda of imaginary sources, books based on weaponized innuendo, paid protesters caught on camera, and circus-like antics at confirmation hearings, against all that noise and misdirection, some real news was actually being reported behind the scenes, and some of it was downright disastrous for the well-being of many Americans. Of particular note is a story carried by Fox News and reposted across the internet discussing how students and families are struggling to repay billions of dollars of onerous student loan debt. This is a subject I have discussed at regular intervals over the years. It hasn't gone away. In fact, its ramifications are intensifying as more individuals and families become aware of just how injurious crushing college loans can be when it comes to getting on with your life after college or grad school. Many are just beginning to realize what a ball and chain college debt can be. And if you get into financial trouble after college, like not finding a job in your area of expertise, or you do find a job but it doesn't pay enough to adequately service your student loan debt and start a life, you find you're living inside a conundrum. And instead of putting wind in your sail, all that debt is an anchor on your tail, especially when you realize your student loan cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. Some of the first-hand examples and observations cited in the article mentioned how the average student debt for the class of 2017 was $39,400, an increase of 6% over the previous year. How Americans owe more than $1.48 trillion in student loan debt, which is $620 billion more than the total U.S. credit card debt. How the average monthly student loan payment is now $351, and currently over 11% of borrowers are 90 days behind in their payment or are in default. How college-related debt carried by 43 million Americans has resulted in more than 1 in 3 of those debtors to postpone buying a house, 1 in 7 to postpone marriage, 1 in 4 to live with their parents, and 47% to put off buying a car. One student commented, "I think it's a systemic issue. High schools push kids to go to college. Kids feel like they won't be successful unless they go. They pick a degree that doesn't have a good job at the end of it, or they bumble around for a few years in college without really knowing what they want, and all the while racking up debt." One graduate said they lie awake in bed trying to figure out how they will ever get out of this debt, and that it's causing a lot of stress. Another said, "We cannot save for a house, we cannot save for a family, and could barely afford to buy a 3-year-old car." He said, "I went to school, studied hard, and got a great job, and yet I really can't start my life for another 10 years because of my financial situation. I am completely run by my debt." Another said, knowing what she knows now, she would have approached her education differently by applying to a community college, perhaps taking a step back and thinking that college isn't right for her at this moment in time. This moment in time. How many actually think about their time and the future quality of their life when accruing what is, in all likelihood, uneconomical debt for unspecified future gains to support a bloated system of higher education that benefits lenders and educators at the expense of your future energy and health? Debt equals time when calculating it against your potential lifespan. When life is being delayed 10 years after graduation for some because of debt, and when events like the 2008 financial collapse that robbed people of their equity and jobs and transferred their years of wealth accumulation away from the accounts of the many into the accounts of the few, maybe it's time to rethink debt, to rethink college, and to rethink life. Father Time takes no prisoners. Perhaps it's time to enjoy the moment and make paradise now, as in right now. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For 2 new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.